Again, I'll start over and say I'm glad to see you all. I came down at 8:30. They have an introduction to Zazen class. And I opened the door, unlocked it, and the wind was howling, and of course there was no one to be seen. So I figured there may be no one here, but I'm glad to see you all anyway. Well, it is the holiday, and as Buddhists we might ask, well, you know, what kind of gifts might we give? Now, not all of us are Christians or whatever, but I think most of us kind of get together over the Christmas and New Year holiday and with friends and family, and at least we exchange something. And that's what we certainly do. And so it really raises the interesting question again, you know, what does a Buddhist have to give? And that's what I wanted to talk a little bit about this morning. And when you look into it, you see that actually Buddhism is really a gift-giving practice, a gift-giving practice. And I want to give just a little background. I see a few new faces for some of you. This review will be review. After the Buddha's enlightenment, he went to find the five aesthetics that he had practiced with. These are people he had practiced with for a long time. And he, in his first talk to them, he gave really kind of the core of his teaching. And these are the Four Noble Truths, the Middle Way, and the what we call the Noble Eightfold Path, or the Eight Wonderful Teachings, if you will. And I want to say just a little bit about them, because out of that teaching really comes a gift-giving from the very heart of a Buddhist, whether you're the Buddha or one of us practicing here in Minnesota in November. The Four Noble Truths, the first noble truth is the truth of suffering. And what it means basically is that we all have some anxiety. Suffering is a funny word. I ride into work on the bus with a guy who one day told me, he says, well, Buddhism, he says, you know, what do you do with a religion whose core idea is the idea of suffering? You know what I mean? And he had a hard time with that idea. But when I think of the word suffering, I think of a whole range of things. For example, will I get the kids to school on time? Will I get to work on time? You know, will I have my job next year? You know what I mean? Will Social Security be around by the time I retire? You know, these kinds of things. Thomas Emerson, I think, is the person who once said, every person lives a life of quiet desperation. And I always remember that. Every person lives a life of quiet desperation. And again, not everyone has a fatal illness or somebody died in their family, you know, but we have this kind of worry. And it's this worry, a whole range of things, that basically cause suffering. But I think in gift-giving, it's important to separate suffering from pain. And I, one example, a simple one, and I have a cabin up north, and this happens to me all the time. You get up at night, you have somebody staying with you, you're making your way to the bathroom, and you stub your toe on something that somebody left right in the middle of the room. They move that chair, and that chair hasn't moved for 20 years, right? Stub your toe, it hurts, that's pain, okay? You go, that blasted son of a gun, why did they leave the chair there? Why does it happen to me? My toe's going to hurt all day. That's suffering, okay? So you always are going to have pain. But suffering is kind of a froth on the pain, if you will, that basically that you create. You know, these are mental constructions, etc. And sometimes the pain is really great and you want to suffer. My wife and I lost a daughter many years ago, and that still hurts us very deeply. It hurts us. That pain is there, but we try to work on the suffering. You know, we try to work on feeling sorry for ourselves or sorry for our daughter and all the missed opportunities and things like this. So this is the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, that we all suffer in some kind. And the Buddha taught, I only teach suffering. And when we read, and if you go to a present moment bookstore or someplace like that, and there are just hundreds of books on Buddhism. You know what I mean? And you wonder, what did the Buddha teach? And the Buddha, I said, that, you know, most basically I teach suffering and the relief of suffering. And this is what we're talking about. Well, the second noble truth is really the causes or origins of suffering. And in Buddhism, we talk about something called the three poisons. And we say that most suffering arises from one of these three poisons. And one is really attraction, or it's want, or sometimes in extreme form, it's greed. You really want something. You know you might not be able to keep it. I'm getting older, and I'm not the guy who used to run around the lake, for example. You know what I mean? I have a great job, but I may lose it. You know, this is wanting, wanting, wanting. It's the foam, if you will, on the pain of actually losing a job or becoming older. You know what I mean? Now, the pain is there, but again, you create the suffering. A second poison is actually what we call aversion, sometimes in extreme form, and we call it anger, hatred, you know, things that you don't want. I stubbed that blasted toe, and I don't like stubbing my toe, etc. And the third poison it has different interpretations, but delusion is a frequent one, etc. And so I work in an office with 12 people. I'm very good at my job, and I let everybody know it, and I let them know how much better I am than they are, right? Suddenly here we are in this financially hard times, and they have to let people go. I am stunned that I am one of the two that's let go. Okay? Delusion. You know, not understanding where you are. Etc. Now, the third noble truth is the realization that the healing is possible, that one can be relieved of their suffering. And then the fourth noble truth is what we call in these grandiose terms the Eightfold Noble Path, or sometimes the Eight Wonderful Teachings, if you will. And there are things like right understanding, right view, sometimes called right resolve, right action, right livelihood, right mindfulness, things like this. And the idea is that if we practice these wonderful practices, etc., that we ourselves basically can heal, relieve that suffering. And again, I want to stress that that doesn't mean that pain doesn't occur, that pain is always a part of life, etc. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to get rid of We're trying to understand and see through that kind of froth that rises on that pain, if you will. Well, in our branch of Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, etc., we have an archetype called a bodhisattva. And a bodhisattva is a person, a male or woman, or in mythology, something in between, if you will, who basically dedicates their life to relieving the suffering of others. And so if we can approach Buddhism, we often do in our early stages of practice, where we have to worry about our suffering. You know what I mean? And this is one of the great things in my mind about Buddhism, is it's not just about others, but it's about you. You're always part of it, etc. We may have to work on our suffering so we can position ourselves so that we can help others. But when we think of things like right livelihood or right understanding or right meditation, etc., it's just not ourselves, but we want to help others. And we also have an idea or an ideal, if you will, in Buddhism called, Buddha nature. The idea that we ourselves basically are free of suffering originally. You know, we have an original mind, etc. And that what happens as we grow, we start developing bad habits, reaction, the way people treated us. And so we start, wanting things and hating things and develop patterns of delusions and things like this. Okay? And so it's really basically part of a bodhisattva's view, not just to work on yourself, but etc., to reach out to others. And to me, this is the origin of some of the great gifts of Buddhism. etc. And when we think of right speech, you know, it's just not us being moral, but us really connecting with somebody else. And part of right speech is deep listening or mindful listening. You know, to really speak from your heart, you have to hear from your heart. And so today I wanted to talk a little bit about the gift of listening. And I think it's one of the great gifts that basically we can give as whether you're a Buddhist or just a person who happens to drop in. You know, somebody said that during our waking, the waking part of our days, etc., about 33% of the time we spend listening. So what a great opportunity, basically, to practice as a bodhisattva. Now, if you're not familiar with Buddhism, one of the great things about actually giving gifts in Buddhism is that you give gifts with no expectation of reward. And in fact, you are overjoyed that the recipient, the person that you're giving a gift to, gives you the opportunity to be open, to be present, to be aware, to be patient. You know what I mean? And so when we talk about some of these things, you know, keep this in mind. Well, how do we become, and this is the holiday season, so I expect all of you when we leave the room today to start putting mindful listening into practice. So we don't have a lot of time. We can start right at tea afterwards, etc. But so we need kind of a quick lesson on how you become a mindful listener. And one of the best places to start is understanding some of the things that make us non-mindful listeners. And I'll just mention some of them because there are some of the things that we can pick up on most quickly. One is to realize that ours is a non-good listening society. And we don't hear that. People don't talk about that. In fact, when we're in school and we're students, we're praised by our quick verbal response. Okay, raise your hand up. You know, and if you watch Jeopardy, you got that button, right, etc. And rarely do you see somebody or a film or whatever praising mindful or good listening, if you will. I might just say a little bit about what mindful listening is before I talk about the barriers, etc. And again, it's listening with full attention from your heart without expectation of reward. Okay, and this is mindful listening. It means that when you're when I'm talking with Paul mindfully, etc. You know, I'm not looking around to see who else I could talk with. Right? You know, I mean, but I really am listening. It's also listening to Paul and not listening to myself. This is mindful listening. You want to hear their story. And nearly everybody wants to be heard. And I don't know if our brochure made it out today or not. At the very front, I ran across this a little saying in an article I read by Ram Dass on an older woman in a nursing home. And she says, I'm not going to read it all. She says, if they only understood how important it is that we be heard. I can take being in a nursing home. It's really all right with a positive attitude. My daughter has her hands full, 3 kids and a job. She visits regularly. I understand. But most people here, they just want to tell their story. That's what they have to give. Don't you see? And it's precious to them. It's their life. They want to give. You'd think people would understand what it means to us to give our lives in the story. So we listen to each other. Most of what goes on here is people listening to each other's stories. People who work here consider that to be filling time. If they only knew, if they had just taken a minute to listen. Okay? So many of us over the holidays are going to be with family and friends. We're going to be with the old grandmother who wants to tell her story. And she's been telling that same story for 30 years. And, you know, you don't listen. There's your blowhard brother-in-law who's the hunter and wants to tell you about his hunting success, on and on. Your sister who's been divorced and has a troubled child who lives in Washington, D.C., who just wants to talk and talk about her problems, but you don't want to talk about it, you know, etc. So you just kind of sit back and you're not mindfully listening, okay? And so there are lots of opportunities to listen mindfully in most of us because one of the big barriers I mentioned to mindful listening is the fact that we have not been taught or told about mindful listening, etc. And when I'm done, I think you'll see that this mindful listening has to be a core practice in Buddhism, etc. It's one of the great ways we can take our practice up off the cushion and out into the world around us. Okay? Okay. Now, so what are some of the barriers? And I mentioned one is, of course, that we're not taught, we're not in a mindful, a good listening society, etc. But there are all kinds of other barriers, etc. And I'm as guilty as anyone. When I first started to read this, I said, oh, yeah. One, of course, is our whole conception of what a conversation is. And Rosemary, etc., changed my life a couple years ago when she she quoted some wag who says a conversation has two parts: talking and waiting to talk. Okay, talking and waiting to talk. And so when the person's talking, in your mind, you're formulating basically what you want to say, right? And you're not listening. How can you listen? A real problem is interrupting, and I have that problem a bit. But also, it's part of the problem it's called the Me Too problem. The Me Too problem. And so here's a situation. You run into an old friend you haven't seen for a year, and she starts to tell you about an experience she had in the Boundary Waters canoe area. That at night when they got their camp and they kind of pulled the canoe up, they didn't pull it up very well. And they woke up the next morning and the waves and the wind had blown their canoe away. And there they were in some distant little bay. And so they didn't know what to do. They waited 2 days. Nobody came. So they decided they were going to make their way through the woods. And what she wants to tell you is, you know, how they bonded. You know, how they worked with each other. And how she found inner strength. But before she can do that, you say, when I was in Yellowstone National Park, this bear came up, and she never has a chance to tell you a story about how important and life-changing it was. And how often does that happen to us every day or to other people who never get the... You're not heard, if you will. And this is kind of the Me Too. Another barrier is, because we're warm-hearted, we want to give advice. You know what I mean? And I can't remember the exact name of this book, but remember it was the one, Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus, something like that, okay. Okay, the woman comes home, and whether these are true patterns or not, woman comes home and she wants to blow off steam. You know, you never know what happened at work today. Geez, you know, on and on and on. And the good house, or at least the husband, or at least the male counterpart, you know, wants to show loving care, and so he gives advice. Well, she doesn't want to hear advice, and in fact, to give advice in most cases is demeaning. Demeaning, if you think about it. These are smart people. They've thought of everything. They just want to blow off steam. You know, they don't want you to, you know, sit there and give them advice. Her husband, on the other hand, if you've read the book, comes home and he crawls into his cave. You know what I mean? He's had a hard day. He reads the paper, watches sports, or whatever, and she'll look at him and say, "Honey, are you in there?" You know. And so she's playing the psychoanalytic game, etc. She's trying to figure out, this guy needs help. See, yikes. You know what I mean? What's wrong with him, etc. So these are kind of typical barriers, if you will. Others are, we assume that a person knows. We assume we know what they're going to say, etc., so we don't listen. Another is we argue with a person. You know, they're trying to tell us something, and we argue with them. Years ago, there was a coffee shop in the uptown area, and I had a friend, John, who was part of that coffee group. It's right near the Uptown Theater. There's just a little empty place that used to be a great coffee house. And John was slipping into mental illness. He came in one morning and he said, boy, he says, it was just great. He says, I went down to Lake Calhoun to meditate this morning. And as I was sitting there, mosquitoes were coming. They were all over me. He says, and I put this energy barrier up and I could just see them bounce off. You know what I mean? Well, Tom, one of the other guys at the coffee group, says, you're nuts. That doesn't happen. You know, there's no energy barrier. You know what I mean? And John needed to be listened to, you know what I mean? And you didn't say, John, did you take your meds? You know, you don't say things like that, you know. But if you're a deep listener, you say, you know, you might, if you really know him, and I was a good friend of his, he eventually was institutionalized. You know, you might say, well, what's your doctor say? Or something like that. So you don't. But then there are all kinds of other barriers, such as blaming. Most of us, what about excusing? Your mother says, why don't you visit more often? Okay, why don't you visit more often? And your mother just wants to talk. And there's still others, etc. Agreeing, disagreeing, etc. Maybe defending, feeling hurt, things like this. Now, why are these barriers basically to heartful listening, to mindful listening? And I think the reason is obvious, that they're all about us, right? It's our actions, our advice, our psychoanalysis, our experiences. Not that person in the Boundary Waters, but my experience in Yellowstone National Park, right? Now, they're all about us, etc., and they're not about the other person. And again, a mindful listener, you're listening full-heartedly, basically, with the other person, if you will. So these are what we call non-listening behaviors. And they're really habits. And this is something to really emphasize. You don't say, I'm going to get rid of interrupting, just like that. Because if you know something about brain studies now, you know that these kinds of habits have worn grooves into your synaptic pathways. Grooves. And it's not easy to change. Some branches of Buddhism call these things prime directives. Prime directives. In communication, everybody, you want to identify, what are my prime directives? What happens when I get into a group? Do I act the clown because I want to be liked, so I'm always funny? You know what I mean? Do I get in the group and change the conversation because I want to be the center of attention? You know what I mean? On and on. So these are prime directives, and as part of our practice, basically, in Buddhism, is we watch for these prime directives, and we realize that they need lots and lots of work. Okay, they're habits, they're really grooved in there, and you can think, if you're a drinker, etc., and you wake up and say, that's it, no more drinking, and then 5 o'clock comes, and there you are, and it's the same with these prime directives, etc., really, really hard, if you will. So those are some of the barriers to mindful listening, and I put them in a Zen talk like this because I think, there are things we can watch for, and they think that it can really be part of our practice. We want to really be mindful of our habits and how we interact with others. So how do we put mindful listening into action, etc.? And obviously, from what I said, one of the first is to identify our own habits, etc., if we can. A lot of times we're not quite capable of doing that. We just don't recognize them. We get carried away. So sometimes it's great to have a spouse or a good friend or whoever actually be part of it. And if they can do it without sarcasm, that's great. There you are again. You interrupted again, I have a little coffee group. As some people know, up at Dunn Brothers up here, and we meet at about between 7 and 8 most mornings, etc. And so I've alerted them about, some of my speech patterns, etc. and they let me know. let me tell you. There are also another really good practice, and I think a very important one, is to really confirm what you heard. One of the really good practices of being a mindful listener is not to let the words obscure the message. Not to let the words obscure the message, etc. They may be trying to tell you something and they're using different words, etc. So I have a brother-in-law, one of these guys, who is an intensive hunter. In fact, decades ago, he's now retired, but decades ago, he became a fireman. Because you're on 24 and you're off 48, and he could hunt and fish, etc. So I was talking to him, and he says, he tells me about, he says, hunting has become more difficult. I must be getting older. You know, I wish I could hunt more. And he went on and on like this, okay? It turns out he has Lou Gehrig's disease. And he didn't want to say, I have Lou Gehrig's disease. You know what I mean? And so he was trying to give me this message, but he was hiding it, basically, afraid. And oftentimes it takes an hour of mindful listening to let really people know that they can really trust you. You know what I mean? That you're open-hearted, you're compassionate, you don't expect return and reward, etc., for people to really tell you basically what's here. Remember Emerson saying, every person lives, yeah, I'm sure he said every man lives a life of quiet desperation. To have people share with you is really a great gift. And the fact that you can accept it and take it in, etc., without judging, without criticism, etc., is truly a great, great gift, if you will. Well, other things you can do is practice. And there's all kinds of opportunities. There are also all kinds of games I might mention. And these sound, maybe not Zen-like, but they're really good ones. And one I like is called the stick game. And there are lots of books on listening, and you'll find these in there. And a stick game, it's best played with three or four people. Not anymore, certainly not just two of you. And the idea is the person who holds the stick basically gets the talk. And then that person gives one of the other three the stick, and they're supposed to respond about what was talked about. But, of course, because there's four of you, you don't know who's going to get the stick. And it goes on. And so you actually learn to listen, etc. And you learn to listen without the expectation necessarily of talking. And so there's lots of things like that. Also, be patient. It's really hard. Those of you who come and sit regularly know you sit in the mat. And we all know we have all these instructions. You sit in Zazen. You follow your breath, etc. You become one focused, and you're thinking about the next instant, the rest of the day, right? Did I lock the car? You know what I mean? Is the dog still in the backyard and is 10 below? Things like this. So we know how hard it is just sitting, etc. And it's the same when we try to engage somebody mindfully, etc. Is that we lose attention, we fall into bad habits, we react, we judge, you know what I mean? And so part of the learning to be a mindful listener is this learning patience. And they always say, when you're learning Zazen, don't beat yourself up. You know what I mean? If your attention slips, just come back. One Buddhist teacher I work with compared to the putting a pencil on the bottom of a cup, kind of a rounded cup, and it keeps falling off, and you pick the pencil up and you put it back on. That is, you bring your attention back to your breath. It falls off. That's our practice. You bring it up, you put it on top, it falls off. It's the same thing in being a mindful listener, etc. You're trying to listen, it's gone. And then you come back. And so this is a lifelong practice, Another thing I might mention, and something obvious, etc., is obviously you don't mindfully listen to everyone. So when I go into Dun Brothers and they say, room for cream, I don't kind of lean forward with compassion in my face, looking mindfully. Did I understand you to say, leave space for cream? You know what I mean? I'm paraphrasing, etc. So obviously, of course, we're always compassionate. We're always open. We're not judgmental. We don't engage in this kind of thing, if you will. I think one of the last things here is to remember your intention. And I think that's important. Because when you start, falling off and reacting, etc., always remember your intention. You're the bodhisattva, etc. You know what I mean? And of course, it's hard. And we're all junior bodhisattvas. If you actually look at the word, you'll see that at least in Mahayana, referred to Shakyamuni Buddha after enlightenment, when he went out basically to teach. And so it often refers to a person who's quite an advanced Buddhist, if you will. If you become a Buddhist here and you go through a ceremony we call the Jukai ceremony, and when you do that, you get one of these little things. My wife calls it a bib because I'm such a sloppy eater, but you're supposed to take them off. But when you go through the Jukai, what we call Jukai ceremony, you take 16 vows, and three of them are bodhisattva vows. Do good, don't do harm, help people relieve themselves of their suffering, if you can, if you will. So again, in our tradition at least, we have this idea where we start to help from the very beginning. So if this is your first day here, and I don't see anyone who's been here for the first day, etc., but you start now. You start now. You don't wait 10 years or 15 years or 20 years until you think your understanding is mature enough so that you can go out and basically and start to be a mindful listener. Okay? It's part of our practice, if you will. Well, another aspect of mindful listening is important to stress is learning to listen to yourself. Learning to listen to yourself. And I've been talking so far about talking to others, but it's often difficult to listen to others if you can't listen to yourself. And here you are with yourself all the time, right, with this great opportunity. And so oftentimes we talk about the witness or the observer in us. You know what I mean? We're not our thoughts. We're able to sit back and watch our thoughts. We're not our body. We can feel our body. We're not our emotions. We're not our anger, if you will. And so part of really learning mindful listening, etc., is to really be aware of what's going on. Sometimes we call this marking, if you will, as far as the thoughts are concerned. Now, there are various names for it. But as these thoughts come up, we usually say just sit there and they're like bubbles and off they go. We don't pay attention to them and things like this. We just sit. But it helps occasionally, etc., to say, well, what's that thought about? Is it worry about work? You know what I mean? Is it worry about health? I find most of my thoughts that come up like that are worry about getting things done. You know what I mean? I've got classes, I've got this, I've got to be here, I'm planning all the time. You know what I mean? And so this is something we can do, be the witness and observe yourself. And how focused can you be on what comes up? And also, part of that is in tuning into the emotions that are associated with those things. You know what I mean? Because we're good Americans, etc., we tend to be too much up here. Too much up here. You know what I mean? And so we're talking to somebody and we have a reaction. And we want to give a retort. And this is a verbal retort. But what's going on here? You know what I mean? Is there anger? Is there hurt? You know what I mean? And these kinds of things, etc. And so remember that when you listen, it's just not listening to the words. And when you listen to somebody, you look at their body. You try to get at the message behind what they're saying. So mindful listening really is trying to get at the message the person's trying to tell you. And oftentimes, they have a difficult time articulating that. They may not know. And one of the advantages of mindful listening is that this comes out. They have a chance to think it through a little bit, etc. So again, it helps to pay attention, if you will. You know, what are the feelings behind our judgments, our reactions, our directives, our primary directives, and things like this, etc. And so all of these are good practices, if you will. Well, let me close, and I'm, if you will, just with some summary thoughts. And one is just to reemphasize, I think mindful listening is one of the most precious gifts we can give. You know what I mean? Just a precious gift. You know what I mean? And you might think, well, there's no money attached. I can give it easily. But it's one of the most difficult gifts to give. And that's very typical of Buddhism. It's easy, but it's the hardest thing you can do. You know, like sitting on your cushion, if you will. And so, again, it's a lifelong practice. And I think for us, I struggle a lot with trying to understand a practice within a Western setting. We're not in the monastery. And sometimes when we talk about Dogen, the founder of our Soto lineage, etc., we say, well, Dogen just talked about sitting. You know, just sitting. But if you actually look into what Dogen did, you know, he had koans, but also the monk in the monastery, their whole lives were regulated. You know, he's got, you know, pages, a book full of, you know, regulations. So he's molding the behavior, basically, of people around him, etc. And if you know something about how you change the brain, you change the behavior. You know what I mean? And so he's producing a certain kind of monk. And so it's really a different kind of system than we have here. And so what can we do? And we all have jobs, or hopefully, you know, we will have a job. And so one thing we can do is carry mindful listening with us as a real practice, because we can always basically practice it, if you will. It helps, too, to remember Buddha's two great teachings. And they say sometimes that you can reduce Buddha's teachings down to two statements. And the first is, help relieve others of their suffering whenever possible, something like that, etc. And then the second one is, if you can't do that or don't know how to do that or whatever, don't do any harm. And I think a person who's starting out to be a mindful listener, etc., you listen to a person and it just wrenches your heart, you know, in some cases. You know, you don't know how to help. And you're afraid if you can't give advice, you don't want to give advice, you just want to listen. And so remember, do no harm. Do no harm. Just listen. I always, as a general rule, I give no advice unless invited. Unless invited, etc. And I talk with people all the time, etc. Okay. Well, I wanted to mention just two books quickly, because some people are readers and others are not. And if you're not a reader, pay no attention, etc. But one book is called The Zen of Listening by Rebecca Shafir. And again, it's a nice introduction. You know, it does the basics. It situates it within the context I talked about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, you know, and things like this. So it's a nice introductory book. And this maybe is for Rosemary, who's going to maybe go into hospice training, maybe, etc. We have a lot of hospice workers here, and this is just a wonderful book. It's called The Wisdom of Listening. And it's edited by Mark Brady, and this is where the cover here, this is where that quote comes from, a Ram Dass article. And nearly all of the articles in here are written by people who work in hospice situations or are therapists, etc. And to me, one thing I really like about it is that hardly anyone uses the B word. And of course, the B word is Buddhism, right? You find oftentimes when you try to take the teachings out into the public, etc., and you talk about Buddhists, etc., and things like this, that people, you know, are kind of defensive a little bit. And so, what you can bring out is the teaching. And a lot of the medical wellness practices, etc., talk about mindfulness. And there's just hundreds of articles by neurologists and things like this on mindfulness, etc. And they found when they tried to introduce it into the southeastern United States that people thought it was cultish and a religion and associated with Buddhism. And so they talked about reflection. And so again, you don't have to stick with words that some people might find harmful. And so now you can read all over the place that people are trying to bring the fourth R into education. Reading, writing, arithmetic, and reflection. Because kids like not learning to listen are not learning to look inside and reflect and be mindful, etc. So again, I think this book does this very skillfully, etc. And again, if you're interested in that. And so let me end just by saying that, again, it's the holiday season. Remember, people, we're all going to meet with family or friends or whatever, etc. And again, what can we give if we're kind of interested in Buddhism, etc.? I think we can give mindful listening. It's really part of our practice and should be. And thank you very much. And I'm sure some of you have experiences about listening or not listening or...
When someone is in pain and is telling their story, at some point they'll stop and they'll look for a reaction of some kind. And my instinct is to try to give advice.
I think it's most people's
instinct. What do the books, what is your experience?
Well, basically you... One of the things I didn't mention, but when you're talking to somebody, you look encouraging. You want to show them that you are engaged. You know what I mean? And so they might look at you, and so you want to say, you want to let them know that you are engaged. But typically, what happens in situations like that is that you paraphrase what they've been saying, and if you want, you might say something like. Did I hear you say that you're worried about not being able to hunt anymore? You know what I mean? You're not giving any advice. You're just letting them open. You're showing them trust. You're saying open. Tell me, etc. And so it's one of the hardest things. But one of the really good ways. And then also sometimes if people are insisting where they really. Really want to talk to you. There's nothing wrong with saying, I hear what you're saying, but I have to think about it for a few days. I want to sit with it. You know what I mean? We always feel that we necessarily, have to give advice and give a response. You know what I mean? Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much.